Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome Greg O'Byrne. He is the executive director of the Santa Fe Wine and Chili Fiesta, and we are here to talk about wine. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for having me.
So you have made wine a very major part of your life. What do we know about the origins of wine? This is a very old drink.
Yeah, some say 3,000 years or older. The Greeks, the Phoenicians brought it maybe to Italy, then into France. So it's been around in the old world, Italy, France, Greece, for 3,000 years.
And it is made through a process of basically fermenting grapes. How is that done?
Well, you just take, like any fruit, as it grows over the season, the acid dissipates, and what you have is sugar. So at the end of the growing season in the grape, you have enough sugar to press. Sugar plus yeast equals alcohol.
And there's yeast naturally occurring on the grape?
There are natural occurring yeasts, and some people will ferment the sugar from the grape juice with indigenous yeast. But for the most part, people are using store-bought yeast to do the job of fermenting the sugar to alcohol.
So you've got basically mushed up grapes, which are very sweet. You add a little bit of yeast, it ferments, it gets to a certain alcohol content, and then it's wine.
Exactly. So, yeah, you can measure the level of sugar in the grape when it's being grown. It's called Brix, B-R-I-X. And basically, you pick the grapes around 26 to 27% Brix, and that would equal 13% alcohol once all the sugar has been fermented to alcohol.
So there's basically there's little sugar left when the wine is done.
Right. It's a winemaker's intention to ferment to complete dryness, or they may leave a little bit of residual sugar in the wine, depending on if you want a sweet wine or a dry wine.
So dry means not sweet.
Right. All the sugar has been fermented to alcohol.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So if you want to grow grapes, you can't just do it everywhere. There are certain conditions that are good for growing grapes for making wine.
Right, right.
And they're different grapes than you would use for making grape juice?
Yeah, the basic grape that Europeans, the varietal is Vitis vinifera. So that is the grape that makes wine. We didn't have Vitis vinifera in America until it was brought over here from Europe. The other grapes like Columbard and grapes that you buy in the grocery store are different types of grapes that you wouldn't make wine from. They're not in the Vitis vinifera family.
So that family has many subgroups which lead to many different flavors of wine.
Right. So there's all these different grapes, Cabernet Sauvignon, Pinot Noir, Merlot, and depending on the grape, they might excel differently in a different environment. For example, just think about the skins on grapes. Cabernet Sauvignon has a very thick skin. So it can adapt itself to many different climates. It can be in a hot climate and the skin won't burst and get raisin. It won't break. Whereas Pinot Noir, a very thin skin grape, prefers a very cool climate. So think about Pinot Noir where it's grown in North America. 95% of Pinot Noir is grown within 25 miles of the ocean between the Columbia River and the Santa Barbara Channel. So it likes a cool climate. That's where it does well. Where Cabernet can pack its bags and pretty much go anywhere, which it's done.
So when you are growing grapes, you're a vineyard and you're making grapes, you've got a lot to deal with. You have the soil, you have the weather, especially if the
right.
grape is more sensitive. You've got pests.
Right.
These are all things. I mean, we had somebody on from Second Street Brewery a while back talking about making beer, and they don't have to deal with the natural world as much.
Right. And I mean, I think it's very interesting with grapes, all those things you mentioned. I mean, if you summarize those things, the word terroir, which is bounced around a lot in wine circles, a French word. We don't really have a translation for that in English, but terroir would be in sense of place. So when you talk about the choice of soil, the aspect, the exposition of the vineyard to the southeast versus the southwest versus the north, the elevation the grapes are planted, the climate, and then also man's imprint over years. Those all add up to what we would call terroir, a sense of place for the grape. So and in these places, it's sort of a different topic. You are dealing with, we bounce around the word sustainable agriculture a lot these days in food growing, but it's true for wine too. If you think about grapes, they are monocrop. So once you plant a Pinot Noir in a vineyard and that's all you're growing in that place, sure, pesticides are maybe a necessity to warn off pests, but other people realize if they plant other things around their vineyard, they don't need to use pesticides. You have biodynamic or organic growing that would exclude the use of pesticides, which is...
Is that right?
Yeah.
What do they grow to keep aphids away or whatever the bugs are?
Well, you might have different plants, you know, on, you know, roses on the end of the rows of vines, or you might have vegetables, asparagus in Italy, artichokes. I mean, you have all different types of plants, so you have a diverse culture of plants rather than just the grape, which help keep aphids away. Or, you know, technically, I don't know all the things about bugs, but
right.
In general, that's what you would do.
So grapes, as you say, in one vineyard, you're growing Pinot Noir grapes or whatever.
Right.
It's a monoculture. But the thing that's so fascinating about wine is it's so not a monoculture, because every vineyard has a slightly different way of doing things, and
right.
Every wine tastes a little different from every other. Is mass production of wine compatible with making good wine?
It can be. I think that any wine is, you know, I think we're blessed to have wine in our lives, and mass-produced wine can be good for us. I mean, it's certainly palatable, but I think that the nuance of wine and from different, you know, sources, if you think of Burgundy and just think of all the vineyards there and the aspect of each vineyard and how the same grape grown across the street from this plot to that plot can taste so different, even in the same vinification with the same oak treatment. It's just different. So I think for an enthusiast like myself, for people who really get geeky about wine, they like to get to know where their wine comes from and get to know all that stuff. But sure, wine like Yellowtail or any mass-produced wine, it's fine. There's flavor to it, and it does its job. I think the question comes down to sometimes are the practices of transportation or the environment, or, you know, there's a new thing in California and Oregon now. Rather than being organically certified, you can be sustainably certified. So how are you treating your employees? How are you treating the land? Do you irrigate? Do you use pesticides? I mean, all those things go into play. So Yellowtail, I imagine they're probably mass producing their wine and using pesticides. So maybe that's not so good. So the answer to questions, I think, is very complex.
We're talking with Greg O'Byrne about wine. So obviously, wine has evolved rapidly, especially in probably the last, 30 or 40 years, but it's a thousands-of-year-old tradition. What are the traditional ways of making wine, and then how have they changed in the modern era? I mean, I remember seeing in a movie or something, ladies stepping on grapes in
right.
a big tub of grapes.
Right.
We don't have that anymore.
Well, you do it to some extent. I think that... it's an interesting time right now. It is 30 years to 40 years is a good marker for how much things have changed. Certainly in North America, you think about California in the mid-60s, Robert Mondavi, one of the first winemakers there in the modern era. Maybe there were 10 wineries in Napa, now there's 500. The same thing has happened in Oregon. In the early 70s, the pioneers there, Dick Erath and Dick Ponzi, they were the first to go there in the early 70s, and now you maybe have 300 bonded wineries in Oregon. You have Washington State, which is the second largest growing region in the country right now, with 300 producers. At the same time, even though wines have been grown and made in Europe for maybe thousands of years, there's more has happened the past 30 years in Italy or France than have happened in the past 3,000. And some of these practices do include modern methods of winemaking. But at the same time, we see going back to traditional methods. So, for example, a modern method of winemaking today in Europe or in America would be more of a clean environment to vinify the wines. Once the grapes are harvested and you bring them into the cellar, how you treat the grapes in the cellar. You want a clean environment. Stomping on the grapes with your feet, that can be okay because you're going to ferment it with sugar and that's going to get all the bad stuff out. But by a clean environment, you might want to think about clean oak barrels. It used to be in Italy for a great Barolo or a great Chianti. Even 30 years ago, the wines were left in large vats, open-top vats, and then bottled when the consumer wanted it. So these wines are sitting in open-air containers and taking on a lot of oxygen, which once the wine is fermented, oxygen can be the enemy of wine. So these wines were oxidized or maybe catching some dirty particles from the airborne, whatever. So now you have more self-contained fermenters and wines are bottled in a more clean environment. So vinification, I think, has been modernized to make wines better. But at the same time, you found maybe in the vineyard, people are doing more of an old traditional practice of dense planting, lowering your yields, not irrigating. I mean, it's just fascinating that, you know, in America, we can pretty much do whatever we want when we grow grapes, where in Europe, the wine laws wouldn't allow you to irrigate. They don't allow you to irrigate.
They don't allow you to irrigate.
Right.
Why is that?
Well, they feel that the wine, it's very interesting, irrigation might help the grape produce more, but wine, in fact, sometimes likes the stressed environment. The vines, if they're stressed, if they're in a soil that doesn't have a lot of nutrients and they're not getting a lot of water, the vines may go deeper into the soil to reach more nutrients there. So it maybe toughens up the vine. And then that might play into yield. If you're not getting a lot of water, a lot of nutrients, you have lower yield on the vine. Lowering the yield of your grape per vine would make each grape perhaps more intense in flavor. So actually, a more modern and old school technique is to go into your vineyard in the middle of the season and do green harvesting. So once the grapes have set and you have clusters, you might go in and drop half your fruit off the vine to lessen the amount of grapes that are left on the vine, so the rest of the growing season, those grapes left there are more intense. Lowers your yield, but makes a more complex or flavorful wine. So you see these things in the vineyards now that are maybe going back to old traditional methods, things like that, or pruning, all sorts of different techniques that are more traditional and perhaps yield a better wine.
I can't even imagine what the scene was like in the parliament where they were debating winemaking technique and making laws about that.
Well, in France, you have AOC laws. Those are the Appellation Original Contrôlé. Those are the wine laws, and they dictate not only the grape that can be grown in a place, but the maximum yield, the minimum alcohol, and also the harvest date. So, and things like irrigation, where that you can't irrigate. Similar in Italy, you have DOC laws, which are almost exactly the same. In America, we're much freer, and good and bad. When you can grow whatever grape you want, wherever you want, irrigate, do whatever you want. Doesn't matter. There's no law here dictating. In America, we have AVAs, American Viticultural Areas. So our government has just said, if your grapes are grown in this geographically bounded area, you can call the wine, you can name that place in the wine. But, the basic difference, I think, if you think about old world and new world wines, in terms of not only just the laws, but in naming the wines, in Europe we name wines by place. Where in France, where in America we name wines by grape. So you think of Bordeaux in France. That's a place. So the AOC laws say in Bordeaux, the grapes that are allowed here are Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, and Cabernet Franc. So a Bordeaux wine is made from those grapes. You just know that because that's what the law says. So they don't say on their wine from France, this is a Cabernet Sauvignon. They say it's a Bordeaux. Well, we're kind of the opposite in America. We'll name our wine by varietal. If the wine is 75% Cabernet, you can call it Cabernet Sauvignon. So it's a little bit different.
Well, wasn't there a liberalization of that so you could, in France?
Yeah, what's happened now in the old world, with Australia and South America and some of the new world regions coming on so strong and making inexpensive wines and naming them by varietal, you do have wineries in France now naming wines by varietal. So you might have a wine from the Languedoc that is named Syrah or something. But in general, most of the wines in Europe are still named by their place. Particularly if they're following the AOC wine law. You can't name a wine Bordeaux unless it follows the AOC wine law. But if you want a vin de pays, a vin of the country, which comes from anywhere in France, you could call it Cabernet Sauvignon if you want. So it's reading your label and knowing the laws, but
right.
It gets complex. But
yeah, I mean, it makes the whole process of going into a store and buying a bottle of wine, I mean, you could study for years to
right.
figure out. But you mentioned a moment ago oak. I mean, traditionally wine was aged in oak. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, centuries ago it was aged in whatever vessel you had. So you had clay pots. The fermented grape juice would go into a clay pot and then be buried in the ground. And then come spring, you'd take that clay pot out and voila, you have some wine to drink. But yeah, oak became the main vessel for wine. And large oak vats or small oak barrels have become the traditional method of preserving wine before it's bottled. And the longer you leave it, or the smaller the oak container, the more oak influence, and the longer you leave it, the more oak influence. So you see a tendency these days I think the pendulum has swung back. Oak became very popular in the 80s and 90s and maybe an overuse of oak. And now you see a more judicious use of oak in the wineries and maybe less oak influence in wines.
Can you taste a wine and know if it has oak in it?
Yeah, I think so. I think that taste is always a good barometer for what's in a wine. I think that oak is would leave a tannic flavor in your mouth, which is a tactile sensation on the back of your tongue. But moreover, I think that smelling the wine, you can smell the oak. If you smell vanilla or dill, these are markers of oak. That vanilla smell is really comes from oak. So if you get a Cabernet that's been in oak for a long time, you can kind of smell that vanilla. In fact, our nose can smell so many things that I think the nose is the marker, the vehicle for you seeing what's in a wine.
Now, if you don't use oak, what do you put the wine in?
Well, for example, a lot of white wines like Sauvignon Blanc would use stainless steel. So you ferment the wine in stainless steel, so you do no oak. So then you have just a clear, bright expression of the fruit. You don't have an oak impartation. I mean, oak is not the enemy of wine. Oak can be good, but it really depends on your grape. Cabernet Sauvignon likes a lot of oak. Pinot Noir, a little bit of oak. And depending on the vintage, how ripe the grapes are, the grapes could soak up more oak than they would if they're in an unripe vintage. So I think it really depends on varietal. But, yeah, stainless steel for some white wines rather than oak is a popular method.
Is all wine necessarily aged?
Not necessarily. Some wines are meant to be drank as young as available and will be bottled as soon as they're fermented. So not all, you know, a barometer of a good wine isn't its ability to age. There's so many great wines that are meant to be drank the year after they're bottled, like Sauvignon Blanc. Even some red wines, Beaujolais, can be great in its youth. Not all wine is meant to be aged.
It's funny, in its youth, you make it sound like a person.
Well, I think that wines do take on characters. There's a lot of analogies to people. I mean, if you think about what we're talking about with the vine, about how it has to toughen itself to yield something better, it's a good analogy for people. I think as we experience harsher conditions, we perhaps become more complex people. And you think about Pinot Noir, again, in Burgundy, one of the more northern wine-growing regions in Europe and in the world. This grape is living life on the edge. Not only is it fighting for nutrients in the soil, not getting any water, but the climate can be very cold at night, and the season can be shortened. And so the grape is barely ripening. And in the years where that's what we want. When it barely gets to where it wants to be and it's done all the stress, it makes the best wine. So it's interesting, and there is an analogy there with people.
Deborah Madison recently wrote a book on desserts, and we had her on the air, and we're talking about that. And one of the things it talks about in her book is that for a lot of fruits, if not most fruits, she said even for melons, you don't want to be watering them once they get to a certain stage of their being fruit. You can water them at the beginning of the season, but as they grow big and ripe, you don't want to water them at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true in grapes, too. I don't know that the technicalities around it, but during harvest, a perfect growing season, you think of these farmers just, you know, bud break, hoping that there's no frost after the bud break, and then hoping there's no hail in July. Then come September, they want like one more week in the grape for perfect physiological ripeness, and they're praying for no rain. Because if it does rain right before harvest, much like Deb said about the melons, the grapes somehow get diluted and take on that water from the rain, and they get more diluted, and after picking them, you have more water than you have grape juice, and it's, you know, so it's bad.
And you can't just evaporate it off or something?
Well, there are technological things that you can do now. So that's part of this modern winemaking. There's spinning cones. You can take the grape juice and it has water, and you can do some spinning cone technology and get the water away. So it's very interesting what's happening these days with the technological side of wine.
We're talking to Greg O'Byrne of the Santa Fe Wine and Chili Fiesta about wine. So here's a dumb question. What's the difference between red and white wine?
Well, it's a very good question. The fact of the matter is this. All juice of all grapes is white. So any grape pressed is the juice inside that grape is white. The color of wine comes from the contact with the skins. So red grapes have red skins. And the longer you let the grape juice sit on the skins after you've crushed it, the more color will be taken into the wine. So, for example, Champagne, the great wine of France, is made oftentimes with Pinot Noir. Well, it's the only grapes you can use to make champagne are Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and Pinot Meunier. Two of those are red grapes. But champagne, in general, is always clear, right? Well, the fact is, when you press the Pinot grape, it's white juice. If you don't leave the juice on the skin, you'll have a white wine. Many rosés are made from the same technique, pressing the red grapes and leaving the skin on contact just for a short period of time makes a light-colored wine. The longer you leave the juice on the red grape skin, the darker the wine.
So it's, but it's not only color, but it's flavor. So the skins impart a flavor.
Yeah, the flavor from skins is what we would call tannin, which is a preservative but also a flavor. So Cabernet is a very thick-skinned grape. So when you leave the juice from the Cabernet grape on those thick skins, you're getting more color. And the longer you leave it, a darker color. And Cabernet is a wine that can age. Because that skin is leaving its deal in the juice, you're leaving tannin, which is a preservative.
So you've got tannin in the skin, and you've also got tannin in the oak cask. So
yes, exactly.
You have to be sure not to overdo the tannin.
Yeah, unless, I mean, some people love tannic wines. I mean, my friend Al, who only drinks Cabernet Sauvignon, if he doesn't get a lot of tannin and oak in a wine, he's not drinking wine. So, and yeah, I kind of tease him about it. But I think, like Doug Schaefer, for example, a young winemaker in Napa Valley, makes a great Cabernet Sauvignon. His dad, John Schaefer, started the winery in the mid-70s. And John used to like to put more oak on the wine than Doug's does. Perhaps Doug teases John, his dad, saying, "Oh, because it's because you're a Scotch drinker." You know, he's an old. Some of these older people who drank a lot of Scotch in the younger days, they like that flavor of oak. I like the flavor of oak. I like the smell and the taste of it. It's not the enemy of wine, but I think too much oak is too much oak. You know, a little bit or moderate amount for me is more pleasant.
So let's get back to red and white wine. The juice is clear in both cases. The red wine is the wine that is stayed in contact with the red skin. Can you, I mean, and we'll talk about tasting in a moment, but can everybody who is, you know, a friend of wine tell with their eyes closed what is red and what is white?
I don't think so. I think it's a hard task. I mean, George Riedel, who makes great glasses, has a black glass just for that same purpose. So we can do that sometime. I don't think it's easy to detect just by nose if you can't see if it's a red or white wine. It's a good question.
When you taste, how did you get into wine in the first place?
Kind of by accident, not necessarily accident, but I grew up in the Midwest, and my junior year of high school, my family moved to California, to the Bay Area. So in the mid-70s, I was exposed to Napa Valley and used to drink a lot of white wines. Napa Valley in the mid-70s was almost 90% white wine, where today it's the reverse, it's 90% red. So back then, we would go to a Grateful Dead concert in San Francisco at Winterland, and we'd bring the Spanish wine-carrying thing called the Boda Bag. We'd fill it with Joseph Phelps Johannesburg Riesling, and, you know, we'd have a little drink of wine at the concerts. And so the proximity of to wine in high school and college was one factor. And then after earning a degree in computer science, I was working in Paris and just started drinking a lot more wine while living in Paris, so much a part of a lifestyle in Europe. And so those two things probably combined to push my passion towards wine.
And so did you start really different? I mean, when you're you know, a teenager going to Grateful Dead concerts, you know, differentiation and connoisseurship aren't really the deal.
Not necessarily. I mean, we liked white wines because they were available to us. And I mean, earlier, I mean, I remember friends drinking Mad Dog 2020, Morgan David, whatever that stuff was, Bonnie Doon, Boone's Farm wines. I mean, I think there's drinking to get drunk and there's drinking for pleasure. And the difference between the two is a fine line sometimes. I think that, let's face it, wine is it's a great thing that we have it in our lives. I mean, it's certainly proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy. But wine is fire. I mean, too much of any alcohol is fire. And I think we all need to be careful with that. So
when you start tasting, I was reading on your recommendation a book by somebody named Kevin Zraley, mm-hmm. who has a wine tasting course. It's a wonderful book for people who are new to this, as I really am, because I'm not that much of a wine drinker. But when you start learning, how do you go about it?
Kevin has a good method. I think you mentioned it earlier today. You look at the wine, and then you swirl the wine, and then you smell the wine, and then you sip the wine. I think those four things. I think even with food, but wine in particular, I think the first thing we do is we look at it, the color of the wine. When your food arrives to your table, you look at your food. I mean, that's the first marker of, is this something that looks good to me? So looking at the wine, assessing the wine for color, red or white, you can see the wine is either brilliant or dull, which might tell you one thing or another. color of the wine. If it's a red wine, if it's orange at the rim, that might tell you the wine is a little bit older. It's acquired some air over time in the bottle. A bright white wine would tell, brilliant would tell you it's very young. So these are markers for wine, the visual. And then swirling the wine, again, I think that it's been said that we have the ability to taste four things: salty, sweet, sour,
bitter.
And bitter. Or umami, the fifth thing, if you're Japanese. Whereas our nose apparently can detect 3,000 different flavors or items. So swirling the wine releases the aroma of the wine, and then smelling it. So I think for me, the nuance of wine for a wine geek like me is in the smelling of it. This can be so fascinating, the aromas that come out of the wine once you swirl it, and different fruit flavors or oak or earthiness or forest floor or acids or all different sorts of animals will come out of a wine in the nose. And then certainly tasting the wine is pleasurable, and your palate will probably echo back to the things you smelled. So yes, smelling, sipping. When sipping the wine, the flavors will come through, and then these things we call tannins, the tactile sensation. If the wine is aged in oak, you'll get those things. And then if the wine is complex, we talk about the finish, if it's a long finish or a short finish. Perhaps the more complex, the longer the wine lingers in your mouth. So does it...
Yeah, well, Kevin Zerli has a little worksheet that he gives
right.
to his students, the one-minute test. So you write down on this piece of paper that what happens in the first 15 seconds
right.
and the next and the next and the next.
Well, after you've tasted it.
After you've
yeah.
tasted it in your
yeah.
mouth. Have you done that? I mean, do different things emerge every 15 seconds?
I think they can. I mean, I love wines. I love savory wines. I love wines with a bite. I love Italian wines. Northern Italian wines with acidity and astringency, and they can be so savory. And in the mouth, they linger there. And if you think about, for me, the main purpose of wine, aside from to get drunk, joking there, the main purpose of wine, I think, is food. And the reason I love these Northern Italian wines with the astringency acidity is that they make your mouth salivate and pucker when you put them in your mouth, which salivation in our mouth is welcoming it for food. And so in drinking wine with food, I think Hugh Johnson, another great wine writer, you mentioned Kevin Zerli, Hugh likes to say that wine is sauce. You take a bite of food, take a sip of wine. I think that analogy is very good. It's like lemon on fish. You have that fish, you squeeze some lemon on it, and it sort of heightens the flavors. I think you take a bite of food, you take a sip of wine, and it heightens the flavors of the wine. And hopefully the exercise produces the whole being greater than the sum of the parts, wine and food together.
How do you know what wine goes with what food?
My friend Byron said it best from La Casa Sena. He said, if you like the wine, you like the food, you'll probably like them together. But there are traditional matches out there. Some of the easiest ones to remember are the ones that have worked for centuries. If you think about the Sancerre region in France, they grow Sauvignon Blanc there. They call it Sancerre. And they also have goat cheese. So you try a goat cheese with a Sauvignon Blanc, it's a match made in heaven. I think these tannic wines we mentioned, like Cabernet Sauvignon, the tannins in these wines really pair well with grilled red meats, particularly if the meat is rare or well marbled. You have a lot of that fatty acid in the red meat, marbling, and the tannins somehow complement that, and they go well together.
I wonder if that kind of wine has enzymes or causes some kind of chemical reaction that helps you break down the fatty meats.
I think exactly that's what's happening. I'm not a scientist, but there is something of that nature happening there.
And so this is traditional, but... I was just sort of Googling around and looking at websites on wine, and they have shown by doing blind tests with people who maybe are not wine connoisseurs, but who know something about wine, if you put the same wine in one expensive bottle and one cheap bottle
right.
and feed it to people, consistently they'll say that the one in the expensive bottle tastes better.
Right, right.
And if you take white wine and serve it to people and then put red food coloring in it and serve it to the same people, they'll use completely different adjectives to
right.
describe the same wine.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a new book about Uncorked or something that basically is that premise. I mean, that, what is the value of wine? $300 bottle, is it that much better than the $10 bottle? And that phenomena of telling people, okay, this is the $300 wine, that's the $10 wine, but really tricking them and putting the same wine in both glasses, they'll often pick the one that they're told is most expensive. I think this is the psychology in our heads. It's like we're jonesing for the wine. We think, oh, this is supposed to be a great experience. And come on, let's face it, that happens in life. You're going out on a date for the first time, you're nervous, or you've been fascinated with a woman for a long time, that first kiss, or that, you know, that thought of our mind plays so much into our pleasure, I think. And wine is so much about context. So my expression is, it's not what you drink, but who you drink it with that counts. I think the same wine in different contexts tastes different. If I'm with somebody I don't know or I feel awkward around them, the wine might taste awkward. Or I'm with a long, you know, old friend who I've known for years, and the simplest wine could taste like the best wine in the world.
Then if you have a wonderful experience drinking a certain kind of wine, you're going to like it again the next time.
Exactly. I think that we have a memory map for that wine. We smell that wine and we go, oh yeah, I remember when I had this before. It triggers all those memories. It's fascinating.
As I was reading the Kevin Zraley book, I saw that there, I mean, and you see this all over the place, there are so many different words used to describe wine. And it's hard because wine has, I mean, smell is something, I mean, we have so many words for colors and we have so many words to describe things that are visual. But to describe smells and tastes, and basically it does come down to smells. Let me read some of the words that were used to describe some common wines. Fruity, lychee nut, grapefruit, grass, herbs, cat pea, green olive, butter, citrus, grapefruit, melon, pineapple, toast, and vanilla.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, each of those words, I mean, those are the wine words we use. They're all markers for a certain type of wine. Grapefruit for Sauvignon Blanc, or grass for Sauvignon Blanc, cat pea for New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, lychee nut for Gewurztraminer. I mean, all those are markers. It's a language that we've kind of all, you know, learned. It's not the only language to use to describe wine, but it is a language.
Is that discrimination against New Zealand?
I don't think so. I think
calling their wine cat pee?
I think, yeah, that's one of the funny ones. But I think cat pee is not a derogatory term at all for the wine. It's a marker. And it's funny. If you ask somebody to describe what they're smelling, I mean, give somebody steak and onions. Ask them to describe what they're smelling. They say, well, it smells like steak and onions. I give my 13-year-old daughter a glass of wine to smell, and I say, what does it smell like? She says, it smells like grapes, you know? So, I mean, these are just markers. I think it's interesting. I think there's Carol Meredith, a professor at UC Davis, who's done a lot of DNA testing on grapes and their origin, wrote the color wheel or the flavor wheel. And those words, a lot of them are in her flavor wheel. If you want to Google it, you can find it. It's the flavor wheel by Carol Meredith. And white wines you might have in the citrus fruit category, red wines more in the red and darker fruit category. So all these markers on the flavor wheel, many of these words are coming from that.
Is there agreement among wine connoisseurs? Certainly there's a market, and the market sets prices and things like that. But is there an agreement among the world's wine connoisseurs of which wines are good, medium, bad, and so on?
Yeah, there certainly is, and I think that it really there's century-old agreements, and many of us follow them still today, and they're basically supply and demand. I think one of the greatest agreements, or that still has stood the test of time, was the 1855 classification of Bordeaux. I think it was Napoleon III during the Paris Expo asked for the Bordelais to classify their wines into groups of what's the best, second best, third best, fourth, and fifth. And basically that classification, 1855, was done just based on price alone, what the wines are fetching. So you ended up with you have maybe 300 chateaus in Bordeaux, and they took the top 61 and put them into five categories, first, second, third, fourth, and fifth growths. And in the first growth, there were just four wines, Lafite, Latour, Margaux, and Haute-Brion. And those were the wines at the time that were fetching the most money per bottle. The English were importing the wine. They called it claret at the time. So they were trading this wine in, you know, pallets of it at the time. So there was a price. And today, when those wines are released, they still have stood the test of time. Those are the most expensive wines, and the second most, the third. And so there's a basic agreement of those are the best. But is the first growth four times as good as the second growth that have fourth the price? I don't think so. I'd take four bottles of the Chateau Montrose over maybe one bottle of the Lafite. I mean, for the same price.
And could you or your most distinguished colleagues in a dark room with the lights out tasting the two different ones even know the difference?
You know, I think that there are super tasters out there, and I don't think the difference is that discernible. you think about the Burgundy example, Domaine Romanée Conti. They're probably the most expensive wines in the world. Are they really worth, in great vintages, the Latache or the Romanée Conti bottle, $10,000 for one bottle? Is it really worth that? No. Clearly, it's just supply and demand. If I put that wine against another great Grand Cru Burgundy in a dark room, would I be able to tell the difference? Perhaps not, you know. So it's a, you know, I think it really is supply, demand, and what the market will bear for price.
We're talking to Greg O'Byrne of the Santa Fe Wine and Chili Festival about wine. You know, the way you talk about it, it sounds a lot like art. So somebody is not a very well-known artist, and suddenly they're in the Museum of Modern Art, and their value goes way up.
Right.
And it's the same art as it was before.
You have the blue chip artists, you have the blue chip wines. So the ones I just mentioned, the first growth Bordeaux or Domaine Romanée Conti, those are the blue chips. So they've fetched the most money for years, and we all agree they're the best, mainly because of price.
Now, Italy and France are the world's biggest wine producers, and they are the wines which we import the most of. Other countries have really come up in the last quarter century in terms of wine production. In the Kevin Zraley book, which is called Windows on the World, Complete Wine Course, in the 25th edition, he was including wines from countries which hadn't even made it into the first editions.
Right, right. Australia started mass producing wines 10, 20 years ago, and we were importing it literally by the millions of cases. They're down a little bit in Australia now because they're getting competition from countries like South America, like Argentina, Chile. They're coming on strong right now. So, yeah, there's wines being made around the world, and there's a lot of great value wines out there today that, you know, it's a good thing for everybody. A lot of great wine out there.
So when you are, for example, working as a sommelier for a restaurant, how do you make those decisions of whether you're going to include Australian wines, South American wines, French, Italian, American?
I think that each restaurant's different. Depending on your cuisine and the personal preference of the person buying the wine, you're going to build your own personal wine list that follows your own palate and what you think goes with your food. But then at the same time, you probably will include wines that you know the public wants. You know, right now, Malbec is so popular. So a restaurant most likely will include a Malbec, and people will buy it just because it says Malbec on the wine list. It's the Merlot of today. 20 years ago, it was Merlot was the popular grape. So I think in choosing your wines for your wine list as a sommelier, you're really thinking about your cuisine, what you can afford to buy, and so forth.
And so, again, like art, it goes in trends.
It does go in trends, yeah. If I'm at Coyote Cafe and I'm buying the wines there, Quinn Stevenson's going to have a lot of great Rhone wines because they go with the spicy food that Eric's making, and that's his passion. If I go to Vinaigrette Salad Bistro, I'll probably find a lot of light and bright wines with good acid that are going to go with salads. So, you know, I think there's that. But then there's also trends, too. I think that, you know, you have to have a nod to what's popular right now on your list to appeal to people.
You're executive director of the Santa Fe Wine and Chili Fiesta. Wine and chili outside of New Mexico aren't things that you necessarily think of together.
Right, yeah, true.
So what's that all about? Do you feature New Mexico wines heavily?
Well, it's funny. We're in our 20th year of the Santa Fe Wine and Chili Fiesta. And I think 20 years ago in Santa Fe, when we started the event, it was kind of chosen during the last weekend of September and a time of year when we're doing our chili harvest. So we use the word chili to celebrate that time of year for us as, you know, sort of paralleling the grape harvest in September. So, you know, grapes and chilies both being harvested in September. So it was kind of the name of the event. And also 20 years ago, I think that the restaurant scene in Santa Fe included the use of chili more predominantly than it does today. I think chili today in Santa Fe, we use it as an enhancer of flavor in many dishes, but it isn't the main focus. I mean, we still have our great restaurants like Tomasita's and Maria's where chili plays center stage. But if you think about restaurants like Santa Cafe or The Compound or Geronimo, you've seen them evolve to a more refined use of chili. The word chili in our name, we're not necessarily promoting chili as much as we're promoting Santa Fe restaurants with Santa Fe Wine and Chili Fiesta. So it's evolved. Does chili go with wine? I mean, some wines do go with spicy food. Traditionally, Rieslings with high acid, Riesling's a high acid grape, usually would go with a wine that has a lot of spice. A wine like a Cabernet Sauvignon with a lot of tannin might conflict with the spicy dish. So, I mean, it's funny. But certainly our restaurants have evolved, and not all of them are using chili to the degree we were 20 years ago.
Do we have significant wines here in the state?
Yeah, I think there's some great wineries in the state. You know, Gruet Winery has become the barometer for New Mexico, having been making wine now for, they've been doing wine for 25 years in New Mexico. Sparkling wine, they're now the fourth largest sparkling wine producer in North America. You can buy the wine in New York, San Francisco, some of the best restaurants in the country. They've done very well. Other players include Casa Rondanian, does some great wines. John Calvin, the owner there, is doing very well. There's a young team of winemakers up in near Taos. Vivac Winery is very good. Yeah, I think that we're doing pretty good. I'm proud of what we've done in New Mexico. Certainly off the radar for most people, but it's an interesting phenomenon.
What is sherry and what is port?
Those are different types of wine. Sherry and port. Port is a fortified wine, so it's grape juice fortified with brandy. And then that wine will stay...
So it's not even wine, really.
Well, it starts from wine. Yeah, it starts from wine. And sherry is intentionally oxidized. It has that oxidized note. It's a different style of wine. These are great wines that, you know, sherry can be a wonderful wine to have before a meal or with soup. Port, a great way to finish a meal with cheese or chocolate.
Sherry is also fantastic in cooking. I made a mushroom dish with shallots and garlic and butter and onions and stuff, but sherry was the main flavor.
Yeah, you think about that. You were asking about the flavor of wine and its role. With food and cooking, there's, you know, it's another example. I think that searing a piece of meat in a pan and deglazing it with wine, you know, it makes it a nice sauce. It has acid and fruit, and those are great elements. And the way you did the sherry with your dish is perfect. Adds that fruit and acid element that plays a role in the food.
I would be remiss if I were not to ask you about the health benefits of wine.
Oh, yeah. I'm fascinated with that topic, and we could talk all afternoon about it. I think that wine is healthy in moderation, and it's all medical journals have shown that the past couple decades, how much wine is in question. But the basic fact, Trey, actually going back to Maury Schaefer's 1991 The French Paradox show. I don't know if you remember that show on 60 Minutes in 1991. It was The French Paradox. Why are these French people drinking so much wine, eating foie gras and all this rich cheese and drinking wine, and they're so thin? And the thing is that...
And they live long and
they live
they're
longer.
Healthy.
Right. So the red wine, the skins in red wine, these have things called antioxidants. And they actually raise your good cholesterol and lower your bad cholesterol. So you could eat, you know, eating these foods the French ate, the fact of the matter was with the red wine, they were raising their good cholesterol and lowering their bad with the antioxidants in wine. I think these things are also present in blueberries and other fruit skins. And you see it now in creams and stuff. There's these anti-aging antioxidant creams. But anyhow, wine is healthy for those reasons of cholesterol. But I also think that... if I think about the way I drink wine, I drink it with food. So I'm not really drinking to get drunk. And when eating food, the intake of alcohol slowed down. And when I'm done eating, I stop drinking. So I think that the companion of wine with food is a perfect way to drink alcohol. That's also healthy. But, it's a fascinating subject. I think that the Danish have come out with medical reports that say 4 glasses of wine for a man per day is good. Whereas Europe, France might say 3, and America might say 2 for a man.
And for a woman, what's it, 1 glass less?
Yeah, probably on average 1 glass less. So I think it's just like a weight thing.
It's a weight thing.
But then there is an issue, and I'm not so sure. I need to be sensitive to it has been proven that wine for men and women is good in moderation. But I think there is I'm not sure about breast cancer in wine for women. There is some studies have shown there might be a correlation. But in any event, I think... In moderation, wine is proven.
I choose not to believe that.
Good. I'm not sure exactly what's happening with that. But.
There's also, I think, something that's really important, which is the balances. And it goes back to chemistry and nutrition and stomach enzymes and things like that. If you eat a lot of red meat and cheese and butter and things like that that are so good, and you don't drink wine...
Right.
You know, and think of that as like a Bible Belt teetotaler kind of diet. Mm-hmm. Those people have more heart attacks than people who do drink wine.
Right. It's been proven, a couple of glasses of wine per day, particularly with that type of diet, is going to help you live longer and help your heart and your arteries and all that.
So for people who want to get more involved in learning about wine, how do they go about educating themselves?
Open some corks. Open some bottles. These guys start pulling corks out. No, there's classes. I know that there's a guy at Amavi Restaurant Michael's teaching some classes that seem like a lot of fun. The book you mentioned, Kevin Zraley's book, is a great introductory book for people who want to get into wine.
Zraley being spelled Z-R-A-L-Y.
Right, exactly. And, you know, there's also wine tastings at wine shops. Susan's Fine Wines has Friday afternoon wine tastings, as does the Liquor Barn and Coco Man. Just attending those wine tastings, there's usually 8 or 9 bottles open. You taste the wines, find out what you like. So we all have our own palate, and we're all, you know, is there, a, you know, the best wine is the wine in your glass, and that's the wine you choose to drink. So everyone's palate is their own. You got to trust your own palate, but like you need to learn what you like. And I think there's nothing better than to try a variety of wines to find out what you like.
You just said uncork a bottle. Are corks going the way of the horse and buggy?
Well, they are to a certain degree. Cork will be around for ages. It's been the romantic greatest wine to bottle. Wine with to as a stopper, but it's an imperfect item. It can, and on occasion, cause a wine to be defective. Corks are cleaned with a bleach, and when using the cork, if it's not totally rinsed off, can leave a taint in the wine called TCA, and that wine, you know, is corked. So disappointing to open an old 82 Lafite bottle that you saved for 30 years for your anniversary, and find the wine is corked. So the alternative,
cork meaning
the
gone
cork,
bad.
Yeah, gone bad. That's the expression. The wine is corked, meaning that the cork has tainted the wine inside and destroyed the wine from the chemical on the cork.
It sounds like you've had that experience.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate. You go, I can't replace this wine. So alternatively, screw caps have become very popular. Today, 50% of wine in Australia is bottled with a screw cap, which is a safe enclosure that won't taint the wine.
And it's easier if you don't drink the whole bottle to close it with that.
Exactly. And there's also glass stoppers now, very popular. Calera's using glass stoppers, as is winery Chenayan in Oregon. These are nice stoppers that you can reuse that won't taint the wine. So, yeah, it's fascinating the way it's going. But I think cork will be around for ages. I think that what's helping the screw caps not only is helping us have better corks left for the other wines that do want to use cork, because so much wine is being made that the cork forests are being quickly harvested, and you know, so I think that there'll be better sources for cork to remain for the wines that still want to use cork.
Greg O'Byrne is Executive Director of the Santa Fe Wine and Chili Fiesta. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
That's my pleasure.
And I just couldn't resist going out with a little Monty Python.
A lot of people in this country poo-poo Australian table wines. This is a pity, as many fine Australian wines appeal not only to the Australian palate, but also to the connoisseur of Great Britain. Blackstone Bordeaux is rightly praised as a peppermint-flavoured Burgundy, whilst a good Sydney syrup can rank with any of the world's best sugary wines. Chateau Bleu, too, has won many prizes, not least for its taste and its lingering afterburn. Old Smoky 1968 has been compared favourably to a Welsh claret, whilst the Australian Wino Society thoroughly recommend a 1970 Cote du Rod Laver, which, believe me, has a kick on it like a mule. 8 bottles of this and you're really finished. At the opening of the Sydney Bridge Club, they were fishing them out of the main series every half an hour. Of the sparkling wines, the most famous is Perth Pink. This is a bottle with a message in, and the message is, beware. This is not a wine for drinking. This is a wine for laying down and avoiding. Another good fighting wine is Melbourne Old and Yellow, which is particularly heavy and should be used only for hand-to-hand combat. Quite the reverse is true of Chateau Chunder, which is an Appellation Contrôlé, specially grown for those keen on regurgitation. A fine wine which really opens up the sluices at both ends. Real emetic fans will also go for a Hobart Muddy, and a prize-winning Cuvée Réserve Chateau bottle Nuisan Wagga Wagga, which has a bouquet like an Aborigine's armpit.
And once again, that was Monty Python. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.